with or without you, it's really meant as, you know, not solving any of the pressing problems, but kind of get somewhere. This work was done mostly with Zohar Nusanov, who is around here somewhere, so it's sitting right there, as well as two grad students in Leiden. Now, strikes are a controversial subject, and I like to say that there is a rationale to that whole controversy. That is, something doesn't fit, and we are sort of forced to think hard and invent somehow new, radical ways of dealing with this. So what is sort of the picture many people have in their mind when they're talking about strike? It's basically this kind of cartoon. That is, at short distances, it appears that the hulls are living on these lines, these rivers of charge, quote-unquote, whatever, which are separated by these magnetic domains. This stuff can become static under certain circumstances. However, in true superconductors, this is not supposed to be static. It's moving, it's fluctuating, quantum fluctuating. At least the way I like to view it is that at short distances, it sort of exists. When you go to longer distances, quantum fluctuation gets more and more heavy. And it crosses over to something which looks much more like a BCS superconductor, having noble fermions, etc. And I like to think the big problem is to connect these two. We really don't know how to do it. Now, how do we know? I think that I don't have to tell anybody here that there are D-wave noble fermions, etc. How do we know that there are strikes? It's basically because of experimentalists. Don't blame me. It's just about rather surprising data. Started out a long time ago, early 90s, with these neutron scattering, inelastic neutron scattering measurements. This is a picture of momentum space in the neighborhood of pi pi. And Epley and Kovacs and all the others saw these peaks sitting here, these incommensurate spin fluctuations. And these days, there were no reasons to think it was about strife. It was much later when basically Tranquillity kicked in. Next to the fact that these fluctuations have an interesting momentum structure, what I find even more interesting is their frequency dependence. So this is a picture by Epley again, a much newer picture. So this is momentum space, and we make a cut through these two incommensurate peaks. This is the energy axis. At low temperatures, there is a spin gap out here. There are no low-lying fluctuations. It only may exceed an energy which is in 2 and 4, like 5 MeV or something, you start to see these fluctuations. Now, at high temperatures, this gap is disappearing. These are the high temperature data. And there's a sense to it that these fluctuations have something to do with quantum criticality. Probably not in an absolutely precise sense, but it sort of looks like it. The temperature where these changes occur is well known to be about the superconducting transition temperature. So Tranquillity's demonstration was nothing else than you do little stuff to high TC, which basically amounts to taking out kinetic energy. And this stuff can acquire a zero frequency component, and it's now clearly associated with the stripe order. I don't think that static stripes are much debated. I think everybody believes that it is more or less correct. And the next step, photoemission kicked in the person of CX Shen. And I guess Steve Gibson did last week already a rather lengthy presentation of the newest data, just to remind you. In photoemission, in the momentum distributions, basically you see these very one-dimensional-ish features which are very apt to an interpretation in terms of stripes. Keep in mind that photoemission is actually the only experiment which can really probe these sort of mesoscopic lengths and timescales. Neutron scattering has a big problem. We basically don't know what's going on above 40 MeV of energy. Photoemission can go to much higher energies, and it's basically the only experiment which is doing that. And that is showing these rather outspoken one-dimensional features.
This is
everything. This is overdoped, I believe. This is underdoped, and this is supposedly optimally doped.
What is being plotted is the integrated overall frequency?
I think so, but I'm not too sure. I asked for a Gucci now, pop again a picture from this group, and this is what I got.
I'm not sure why you took the neutron experiments as evidence for stripes.
Oh, it's very simple. This is 2 and 214 at about 50% doping, you put in neodymium, which is after every measure a small operation, you change very little, right? And you get static Bragg peaks at these positions, momentum positions, where otherwise these dynamical fluctuations are. You also get these charge ordering Bragg peaks, right? And that's then interpreted in terms of these stripes. It's just the fact that the action is purely temporal. The momentum space missing is changing. It's basically like a slow down when you put in neodymium.
What was the energy gap to begin with?
Here it's 5 MeV. And in 1 to 3 claim is that very similar things happen, except that the scales are much larger, like 20 MeV in underdoped. 1 to 3 where it looks like striped things.
I thought the story is changing on that.
Yeah, I know. I will refer to that.
How does the dynamic signal change? I mean, does all the waves just collapse into the delta function?
We don't know, right? There are no good data.
They're dynamic measurements in the neodymium. They look very similar to the neodymium free.
So what happens to the gap? I mean, if I just take these data, then what changes?
I'm not aware of good data. I don't think there's very... The problem is very, very practical, that neodymium eats neutrons. So it's very hard to do in elastic neutron scattering measurements in neodymium doped samples. And there's here and there a data point, but it's far from complete.
Yeah,
I haven't seen data.
A picture like this, but if you look at like 3 MeV or something like that, it looks very similar. You can't.
But there's nothing here at 3 MeV.
Yeah.
The gap is 5.
Right. It's above TC.
What happens to the properties as you add neodymium, other properties?
TC goes down, and there is a sense that there are actually two phases. One of them appears to be non-superconducting, and it's very strange, and I'm going to talk about it. The other one, you might think about it as a coexistence phase, which is both striped and superconducting at the same time. Although the book is not close on this, I mean, I'd like to think that there are many more experiments needed to exactly figure out what these so-called striped phases are. So I'm coming back to that. Now, the big problem in this, to my mind, is I can basically reconcile the fluctuating stripes with superconductivity and everything, except for one nasty feature of the superconducting state, which are the nodal fermions. Nodal fermions are, of course, very important because they are low energy excitations of the superconductor. And I don't understand how to combine nodal fermions and stripes. And the argument is not only mine, other people also use the argument. Stripes are supposed to be basically like charge density and spin density waves. So they're supposed to be like potentials for electron-like quasi particles. Nodal fermions are supposed to be electron-like quasi particles. They're supposed to scatter against these stripes. How can it be that these nodal fermions can propagate under these 45 degrees angles? With these stripes. It's a 45 degree problem. And this makes me very nervous, and I don't have an explanation for this. I'm thinking hard about it, so I warn you, everything I'm going to say is, you know, I know that there's something missing. Another feature of the superconducting state, which is very annoying for stripe fans, is what happens in optimally doped 1, 2, 3. Well, in neutron scattering, in elastic neutron scattering, spectrum looks completely different. There's this big peak sitting at the conventional momentum of pi, which seems to suggest it's more like an antiferromagnet. There are still these remnants of these incommensurate fluctuations, but they appear to be rather strongly temperature dependent than everything. So, an interpretation in terms of stripes is much less solid in these cases. Toward the end of my talk, I will come up with a suggestion with what this could be, which is yet different from a complete and closed, etc. theory, but at least a suggestion how to reconcile this magnetic resonance with what I'm saying about stripes. How can that grow out of stripes?
The 40 MeV is only in the superconducting state, right?
Yeah, but in underdoped 1, 2, 3, 60K, it's still there above TC, right? Yeah, in optimally doped. But the problem is really this continuous evolution. You could argue that in 60K there's still sort of stripe signal. And it continuously evolves, apparently, in this somewhat RPA-ish looking optimally doped state.
Yeah,
RPA explains a lot more than stripes in that case. So I guess there are basically two extreme opposing viewpoints on what all this means. The first viewpoint is stripes are an irrelevancy. I like to say that the implicit assumption is made that there's a tough first order boundary between stripes, which is physics 1, and superconductivity, which is physics 2. We do understand that in the presence of Quinn's disorder, this tough first order boundary can sort of smear out. It seems to be the physics of manganites, where you should read here the metallic ferromagnetic state and here the charge order state, whatever. When you believe in this viewpoint and you study superconductivity, there's no reason to worry about stripes. And I like to think that some theoreticians are thinking this way. At the same time, it's a prejudice.
Nicolets definitely have well-defined stripes which you can see in elastic scattering.
Yeah. The next viewpoint, and it's basically the theme of my talk more than anything else, is why worry about stripes? There are more subtle ways of breaking the knob, of getting rid of them. And when you follow these subtle ways of breaking the knob, they appear as extremely interesting, at least to my mind, and that's the message I want to get across. What is the message? This will also be my summary sheet. Stripes are a highly organized form of electron matter. There are many forms of order, or a couple of forms of order at the same time. But we try to destroy this order step by step, and we can do it in a whole progression of second order positions. We can first focus on the charge order, basically. And there's this possibility of these quantum liquid crystalline phases. This theme was introduced by Steve and his co-workers, and I'm basically jumping on the bandwagon here. We'll sort of review that shortly, and especially ask your attention for a next quantum liquid crystalline state which can exist here, which we call the ideal nematic, which I perceive as a rather beautiful object. It's sort of a force of topology coming into play here, and this could actually relate to existing data. Steve also has a suggestion here for a state which is very similar, and it could also apply to your data. So we have basically two alternatives for strange data here. These quantum liquid crystals are supposed to occur at rather low dopings, where you wouldn't think that the best superconductors are. There's also a second sector to the problem, which can be viewed to some extent as independent from what the charge is doing. It's basically about a spin, and I don't call it want to give away what I'm doing here, just saying that very peculiar things can happen here as well. And that will be the second part of my talk. And this quantum liquid crystal stuff is to some extent an introduction to the second part. That's a long program to go, and I try to go quickly. Now, why do I have the guts to put on all these different faces out there? The reason is that I adapt basically one theoretical principle, which is duality. And duality is here in Santa Barbara quite popular, and actually got sort of infected with the general way of thinking here when I was here last year. Basically coming from Central Fisher, etc., from Tony Z. The way I want to formulate it is actually more something for this session, this Brownback session of an hour ago. Duality seems to have this strange implication that at zero temperature, at least, everything is order, except when they arrive at the critical point. In the following sense, duality can be put as an algorithm. An algorithm is start out as an ordered state and describe it mathematically precisely by finding the order parameter. Then use the weaponry of topology to enumerate the disorder operators, which means a single entity of this kind suffices to completely disorder the system. And this can be precisely enumerated using topology. Then, at the phase transition to the disordered state, these topological excitations proliferate. They start to seed in a vacuum. They form a new form of matter called a disordered matter, and this disordered matter is apt to symmetry breaking. And this condensed state of disordered fields then represents the disordered state, which is deep inside again ordered. It's the order of disorder operators. An archetypical example of this of duality is called in field theory Abelian-Higgs duality in 2 plus 1 dimensions. It's very well understood and used a lot. The context of condensed matter physics is basically looking at quantum phase dynamics. So let's start out with a superconductor or a superfluid, beautiful superfluid, with an action of this kind. We all know that by adding a charging energy to it, we can quantum disorder the superfluid, and the competing state is a more insulator, where all the charges are fixed. Now, the statement of this duality is, I perceive it as very beautiful. Start out with the phase order, we know what it is, that's basically the XY spin system. Then a topological excitation in 2 plus 1 dimension is this vortex particle. And then the miracle is that at the phase transition you can think that these vortex particles proliferate, so they form a soup of vortex world lines in space-time. The soup of vortex world lines in space-time, both Einstein condenses, and that is the most insulating state, is a special effect that a relevant field theory associated with this vortex matter is actually a Ginzburg-Landau, meaning it's about a charged superfluid. Ginzburg-Landau has a Meissner effect, meaning that there are no low-lying excitations, and the absence of low-lying excitations is nothing else than the fact that the competing state is a mod insulator.
Is there other phases possible in this description?
No. That's all there is.
So there are counter-examples where there are more phases on the phase.
Yeah, I'm coming to that. And that's basically this liquid crystalline theme is about that. This can all be caught in explicit mathematics, field theoretic manipulation, which I also perceive as very beautiful. This I owe to Tony Zielos here, who beat me hard on my head with this. And just to give you an impression, I don't want to go into any detail, but it's just illustrating the simplicity of the machinery. You start as saying the collective fields can be separated in smooth parts and singular parts. In a continuum field theory, there's infinitely smooth part as compared to singular part. So singular means it happens at a point. Then you can define a topological charge, and we're all familiar to that, integrate around this vortex, and you pick up 2 pi times an integer, where the integer measures the number of vortices enclosed in a loop. By Stokes' theorem, you can translate this in a vortex current, measuring the density of vortices.
Do those arrows refer to you're going off into some other space?
No, these arrows are simply phase order. This is simply the phase order of the superfluid. Right, these are XY arrows.
I'm trying to see stripes.
This is not about stripes, it's coming.
Okay.
Right, I first want to do some, you know, theoretical background. Well, what kind of theory I'm using, what's the way of thinking behind it, and stripes are coming, John, on one few graph from now, basically. Then the next operation is a simple Hilbert-Sultanovich transformation introducing new fields psi mu. Then it's easy to see that you can integrate over the original phase fields, and you get a conservation law for these fields psi mu, and these are nothing else than the superfluid currents. This expresses the conservation of superfluid currents. However, there's also the singular part of the fields, these vortex parts. When you shuffle things around a little, what do you find? Excuse me, I should first say, because the superfluid current is conserved, it can be written as the curl of a gauge field, auxiliary gauge field. Then when you shuffle things around, you find that it basically creates a term, B mu, J mu. In other words, this gauge field parameterizing the superfluid current couples minimally to the vortex current. At this point, you're basically at this Ginzburg-Landau. You spread this out, it's 2-for-1 vortex. For many vortices, it means that you get a Ginzburg-Landau-Wilson series. It's a Meissner effect. Now, let me now come to stripes. See, it's not enough fugal, as I promised. This is basically the main assumption I'm making, which is believing what Steve was telling us last week and what Doug has also been telling us for some time, namely that stripes are a way of making RVB to work. That is basically saying that stripes can be like a system of two-leg ladders. Then, at the end of the day, you get basically attractive interactions between the charges. You can sort of see it here. This is an explicit calculation by Steve White. This is a stripe, and you see on this stripe this density wave sitting. This density wave is a 2KF density wave of qualified system. You can think these are pairs of holes ordering here on the stripes. So I will assume that I can get away with bosons. This is a major uncertainty because nobody knows if stripes are indeed made out of bosons when they are made out of fermions. The theory will be nevertheless will be somehow different. However, with bosons, I know better what to do. So this is the main assumption I'm making. I'm far from sure that this is right.
So he wasn't a
Cooper pair? Yeah, there are two holes, right? Cooper pair. Now we have to ask the question, what the heck is stripe order? Because when we want to address how we want to meld it, using these duality ideas, we have first to define what the order actually is. Stripes are clearly a form of charge order. So all these holes are sitting there on lines. And there has to be a state of stripe which is insulating, saying that you have a 2KF density wave on the sides, whatever. So we have to destroy this charge order. That will be in exercise number one. Secondly, stripes are a form of spin order. To the best of our knowledge, it's a collinear antiferromagnet. It's in the Yale state. We also have to destroy that. And I don't want to say much about, you know, destroying the spin system by spin means. There's a third aspect which I find myself the most interesting and the most unusual, and I like to think quite generally somewhat underestimated. Stripes are anti-phase boundaries in a spin system, and it's clearly a form of order. I'm claiming that in any experiment which has claimed to have seen stripes, these stripes have been anti-phase boundaries, at least in Nicolaides and cuprates. What the heck is this anti-phase boundary meaning? First part of my story will be about destroying this charge order. Second part will be about destroying this anti-phase boundariness, and there I have to think harder. There's now one. You see, this is a bit of a miracle type of thing. There's one elementary topological excitation which basically takes care of everything, and it's extremely simple. It's a stripe coming somewhere to an end. What is this? It is like a conventional dislocation with regard to the charge order. It's just an additional row of atoms, now it's electrons, right, coming to an end halfway in a system. Dislocations, we know what they do. They destroy translational symmetry breaking. They restore translational invariance. This will be this business about these liquid crystals. It's all based on the fact that these are dislocations.
And this B is discrete.
B is the Burgers factor. I'm coming to
discrete.
That.
Discrete. It has finite number, whatever, four directions. And has unit magnitude.
It's actually, yeah, exactly. In a tetragonal crystal, in an isotropic space, it's an O2 factor. In a tetragonal crystal, it's C2. I'm using it later. Secondly, these stripes coming to an end quite clearly disrupt this antiphase boundariness. And that's of relevance to part two of the story. Now, let me first address the destruction of charge order. It might be that all of you know this, but nevertheless, I cannot resist the temptation to review this. It's about elasticity at the end of the day, right? Stripes are a charged crystal, and they're a crystal like many other crystals. Crystallinity is deep inside a quantum concept. Crystallinity, in a strict sense, cannot exist at any finer temperature. In the following sense, in a pure crystal, you would say, I have a crystal lattice, and to every point in the crystal, I can associate precisely one unique atom, and it's sitting there for all the time. Now, at any finer temperature, you will have interstitial substitutional excitations. And they will destroy this association of a atom with a particular lattice site. Why? There's a finite probability that an atom will move away from its particular lattice site, diffuse through the lattice, and other substitutional defect can come to this interstitial and fill it. However, at zero temperature, that's different. At zero temperature, we're supposed to do quantum physics, and everything becomes world lines, and we can think that we can do statistical physics in space-time, but it's now the statistical physics of lines. So it costs a finite energy to create a dislocation. When we try to make a line, a world line of interstitial or substitutional, whatever, we have to pay an energy which is like the length of the world line times the core energy. If this would be all, it would never happen. However, there's also quantum kinetic energy, which is like entropy in space-time. These lines can meander, right? And when this meandering entropy gets large enough, these lines can become infinitely long. Meandering entropy goes itself also like the length of the line. Hence, there's a critical point where these lines will blow out and become infinitely long when we are at temperatures or coupling constant kinetic energy below this critical point. They can only occur in closed loops, and these are virtual excitations. So interstitial substitutional pairs, interstitial substitutional excitation can be rigorously suppressed at zero temperature.
I'm still on this issue. If you have one-dimensional order, then the point defects are in the thermodynamic objects. But the way you are drawing your defects, in two dimensions, there was an energy proportional to length, and so they have to be continuously connected.
Yeah.
Which meant to me that the entropy that existed is only the entropy of the endpoint, since everything else is connected together, and therefore that's not I cannot get an extensive free energy.
It's an absolute standard argument. I mean, you have to make these closed loops, right? The particles, a world line, a particle hole pair or something. It's a closed loop, and then the length of the loop.
I can make point-like topological defects which are thermodynamic, but the way you are making them by inserting a row of extra atoms, you sure it's thermodynamic?
These are point defects.
They're like vortices.
He's not talking about vortices yet.
Yeah.
No, but he's talking about...
Look here. I mean, this is then a dislocation,
mm-hmm.
Right? And this is one point. The core of the dislocation is one point.
It's a point object.
Yeah, it's a point object.
That was your question, right? No question.
Yeah. Right? So we can repeat the same argument for these dislocations we did for these particles. Right? Now, all textbooks in metallurgy learn that the core energy of a dislocation is usually much less than the energy of a substitutional or interstitial defect. This is a matter of specific microscopy. You can never be sure about it. But there's no reason to believe, especially in the stripy context, that it's not true in the stripy case. In other words, there's this explicit and general possibility that the quantum melting occurs as follows. You first hit a point where the dislocations proliferate, while the substitutional interstitials are still completely suppressed, only occur as virtual excitations. There's a second transition where these particle-like excitations proliferate. And when everything is made out of bosons, this will be a superconductor or a superfluid. Because these particles themselves are like bosons, and they can widen everything, and it will become directly a superconductor. It's like solid, super-solid theme, very well understood. So the statement is that there's a region in principle between a crystal and whatever superconductor object, which is entirely made out of quantum dislocations.
Where is that in the matrix?
The matrix is next sheet.
sorry, but your dislocations are like the real crystalline dislocations.
Of course.
They restore energy, right?
No.
Well,
you have a single dislocation, then there's a core energy plus an energy associated with a long-range deformation, which diverges logarithmically with the size. At the moment that you have a finite density of dislocations, right, this logarithmic energy is cut off by the average distance between dislocations, everything becomes finite. Very well. So it's like a vorticess. It's no different than a vorticess.
In this picture, yes, but in the previous picture, it was clear that you're going to have, you destroy the antiphase order, and this antiphase order is going to be destroyed along the entire...
I'm coming back to the antiphase order later, at length. Good question, and I'm going to give some kind of answer to that.
That's the same picture as
Yeah, except that this is melting in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And it makes up a big difference.
Well, just to make sure that I understand, the phase between the crystal and whatever is happening too far, right, is something that's translational invariant.
Yeah.
And it's not a, say, the boson system, it's not a superfluid.
I can answer you now if this is superfluid, etc. Let me just go on for 1.5 years ago. Okay? Let me just continue. I have to tell a little more. Because this is not yet the whole story, because elasticity is a far more interesting theory than phase dynamics. So this is a theory of elasticity with a neat elastic tensor out there. This is a tensorial theory. U are the displacements that can be in x and y directions. Then you take a space-time derivative of it, and it necessarily gives a tensorial structure of the theory. Dislocations are sort of the good news in this, because dislocations are deeply encycled, very different from vortices. You can proceed in the same way. Integrate in a loop around the dislocation. It works the same way as in vortices, except that there's an additional label hanging around here, which means that the topological invariant is not no longer a number, a scalar, but becomes a factor, and that's the Burgers factor. There's a sense of direction. It also means that you can define a dislocation current, and that's a tensorial current for the same reason. So instead of the simple vector theory associated with phase order, you get now a tensorial theory. If this would be all, not a big deal to write something down. However, there are also so-called disclinations. Dislocations only restore translational invariants. You need disclinations in order to restore the rotational invariants. And disclinations are bitches. They're very hard to handle theoretically, and it sort of shows that the tensorial theory can be really much harder than simple phase dynamics. Stronger, disclinations can be looked at as bound states of dislocations, where the dislocations have the Burgers factor all pointing in the same direction. Look at this cartoon. This clearly causes rotations in the lattice. What you also see is, directly from this cartoon, that when you have these disclinations, you can always peel off a dislocation. A disclination is supposed to be an infinitely long line of these objects. Hence, dislocation current is no longer conserved. And disclination density acts as a source for the dislocations. This causes all kinds of horrible problems. However, viewing this cartoon and now interpreting literally as stripes, if it would be really like that everything here would be infinitely long, a disclination would be like an infinity of dislocations, hence its core energy would go to infinite. Hence it can be made infinitely expensive. This is only true at low vorticity. You will never get here in real life in nature. However, the argument makes clear that a disclination can have a much higher core energy than a dislocation, so it can also be suppressed. The suppression of disclinations is a definition of a pneumatic. No disclinations, rotational symmetry remains broken, and you have a pneumatic state. As said, when you have disclinations around, I like to believe that the problem is basically unsolved. I can refer to a book by Kleinert, who's trying to handle this problem, and he didn't quite manage to get it done.
Single particle excitation, the gap,
that's what I am assuming, right? Which is an additional condition. So there are no single particle excitations, they are gapped. And I assume that discriminations I get two, and only dislocations are proliferated. And I'm claiming that that's an admissible state of quantum mechanical zero temperature on general grounds by these simple arguments.
Why should
there be a
gap? Do you have any
understanding? It's just this good old-fashioned metallurgy argument that dislocations are formed because they are bound states of substitutionals, and by forming bound states they break less bonds and therefore they are cheaper. You find this in any metallurgy book. I mean, in a normal piece of iron you find far more dislocations than substitutional or interstitial defects.
That's in the crystalline state, okay?
Yeah.
Going away from the crystalline.
Yeah. And I'm claiming, right, that the logic, the same logic, still holds in this state which has only dislocations. There's a second transition later on where these particles will proliferate in the vacuum. Okay? But there's a state where they're suppressed. Given this sort of near vortex-like behavior of dislocations, then basically Kunsch, the standard machine, which I showed, the Stoney Zeising and what knows Major Fisher and Central, etc. And I don't want to go through this. At the end of the day, what you basically find is, it's just like this quantum phase duality, except that you have now a flavored theory. All these fields carry an additional flavor, which is referring to this Burgers factor.
A quantum theory should have dynamics, and there should be something like a mass for these. Yeah. Are you going to talk about that?
Okay. So, in your talk so far about, just to clarify, if you were talking about a classical model, you would be talking about dislocations or discriminations in a classical model, which would be some variant of the XY model.
Not quite, like you mean you need a crystal
symmetry. You're quantizing, you're making a quantum version.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So far we don't have any fermions.
I've actually been sort of funny because at the end of the day, what I'm doing here both works for fermions and bosons. And that still has to come.
I understood you had some kind of perfect order, and then you were doing the statistical mechanics of some topological defects in it.
Yeah, or, you know, according to post-integral wisdom, quantum mechanics is like statistical physics in one higher dimension, right? That's what I'm using. The special conditions like, you know, substitutions and interstitial can be completely suppressed, which can never happen in the classical context. And that makes a difference. That's actually the big difference.
Of course, but you're not going to say there are some, there's an extra fermionic degree of freedom attached to these defects, or it makes extra quantum numbers, or is that what you
say? Let me just continue. I mean, this is, you will get a clear answer to this question.
I want
to
be sure, you know where, I know where you are right now.
Anyhow.
So your d plus one dimensional or 2 plus 1 dimensional elasticity, is that omega squared plus qx squared plus qy to the fourth?
This is a mass term, right? I mean, when I say g mu nu alpha beta, right, it's really like there are strain fields of this kind, x and y are space directions. World lines are incompressible, so this thing does not exist. Right, and what there is mass terms, which is basically rho over 2 delta u x squared plus rho over 2 delta u y squared, is at least part of the mass n equals s squared. So basically coding in this.
So if this is a, so is this a lattice model, or, because in the continuum you know that one of those gradients has to be zero. One of those terms has to be zero by symmetry. There's a q to the fourth. Yeah, so in the semantics, the bending distortions are very cheap.
Semantic.
No, but he starts with an ordered strip.
Yeah, but it's a crystal.
It's crystal focus. I'm jumping over semantic. I mean, semantic is an explicit additional possibility sitting in there. I'm not excluding it, or anyway. I mean, this is just the simplest way I can discuss it.
Yeah, let's say we're just talking about a system of bosons. So then I'm a bit confused about this intermediate phase. I seem to recollect that people have proved theorems to the effect that a system of bosons either breaks translational symmetry at zero temperature, or if it doesn't, it's in a superfluid Chrome state.
I was thinking of loop something. Who did it? You said?
I don't know. This folklore,
I think it's folklore. Like I call it. I mean, this is where I want to provoke you. I call it break that logic. Let me just continue for a second. Let me just continue. I mean, your question is exactly the question to which I hopefully have some interesting answer. So I can now push things further. And the bottom line is, I don't want to take too much time as detail, is that you get a flavored version of this Ginzburg-Landau-Wilson action, which is basically saying there's a director order on board. What does that mean? Now, if you go to a guess of dislocations, they all carry this factorial freedom wisdom, this Burger vector degree of freedom. All I can say is, discriminations are forbidden. Discriminations are pieces of ferromagnetic Burgers vector. They're not allowed to occur. So all that can happen is that these Burgers vector line up microscopically in an anti-parallel fashion. It's like a plasma of these particles, a quantum gas of these particles, having these internal degrees of freedom doing the anti-ferromagnet. This is a direct order parameter because there's as much pointing, say in this case, to the right as to the left. And director means it's like, say, in isotropic space, an O2 vector, except that north and south pole are associated.
What is this label A, this flavor label, how many components do you have?
In two-dimensional space, there's two components. It's this O2 thing, and it's actually a director.
Two flavors of,
yeah, of everything, right? You have these gauge fields describing the disordering influences. I mean, the gauge field is strain, and the different dislocation currents govern different.
Dislocation and the A vector is a Burgers vector that either do this or do that.
Yeah, exactly. So, in other words, this breaks the orientational order, and the order parameters is directly which can be looked at as a condensation of Burgers vectors. So, this is actually nothing else than repeating, I think, well established wisdom. Now comes the part which is sort of in the metallurgy book, but I like to think that the real workings of this get only manifest on the quantum level. That is, I can now look at the dynamics of this quantum pneumatic state, and I can do that by, for instance, coupling in an electromagnetic field. This is the way electromagnetic fields couple to displacements. I can work my way through to find out that actually the Maxwell equations are completely changing. The electrodynamics of this purely dislocated state of matter is entirely different from anything we are used to. The first one says that it builds up an electric field which is part perpendicular to the dislocation density, which is basically the time component of the dislocation current that we use again as Burgers vector label. And even more disturbingly, there's no way of accelerating dislocations in electromagnetic fields. How to understand it? It's very easy to understand it intuitively. The first statement is, what do we do with a dislocation? And now I'm relating it to a charge crystal or weakened crystal. We put in this half infinite long row of additional charges. Hence, instead of having this simple Maxwell equation, standard one, we have to integrate over this row of charges. And we find, instead of this E being proportional to the density, we find that E itself is proportional to the density, however, under a right angle with regard to the Burgers vector. Burgers vector is pointing like this. Additional charges come in like this, and the electric field is pointing like that. So that explains the first one. Now the second one, I think the real interest is, and this is some deep ramification of topology. Having these factored topological invariants, they also control the dynamics. In classic mythology books, it's called the Clyde principle. These locations can only move in the direction of the Burgers factor. Very easy to understand drawing striped cartoons. So here's a dislocation, I want to move it. What to do, I take a next stripe, I cut it, I move over this tail of stripe with a couple of microscopic hops and spin flips or something. I reconnect the stripe at this dislocation and I move the dislocation. So this is a freely propagating quantum motion. Now I want to move the dislocation perpendicular to the Burgers factor. What I need to do is to make this stripe longer. In order to make this stripe longer, I need three charges, which are substitutionals. And I've just argued that substitutional density in the Gaussian can be zero. These particles are not around, so this dislocation can only glide. Now I apply an external electromagnetic field. The electric fields are pointing in this direction. It can only move in that direction, so nothing happens. At the same time, this motion is purely one-dimensional, so magnetic fields cannot do anything. So the thing completely decouples from external electromagnetic fields. Stronger in a macroscopic state, these Burgers factors line up. In other words, this motion lines up, and what I've accomplished here is that I find a state, although it started out to live in two dimensions, that by spontaneous symmetry breaking has become a purely one-dimensional state. You might think that I have done a dynamical compactification, got rid of a dimension.
Why can't the electric field be this way?
Just because of the simple argument, right, that I ensure this half infinity of charges, right? But the Burgers factor is always pointing perpendicular to this line.
Well, your question is, what happens if the electric field is parallel to the Burgers factor?
Yeah.
Nothing, because you haven't inserted any additional charge. I mean, it's basically like this relation that electric field is always perpendicular to Burgers factor. Emotion is parallel to Burgers factor.
So in this,
we have to calculate actually to convince ourselves that this is right.
Your Burgers factor is always perpendicular to this, right? So why, what's the other degrees of freedom that you were alluding to? How can you draw a dislocation with Burgers factor that's 90 degrees? What's the picture of that? That's only one component.
I mean, a striped crystal is orthorhombic, right? So you have an A and a B axis, which are different. So I don't really want to put this on the blackboard. The dislocations perpendicular, this Burgers factor parallel to the stripe direction, make the stripe sort of metallic, right? They melt the charge order inside the stripe in essence, but in a two-dimensional fashion.
What kind of?
I mean, when you take a normal, say, square lattice crystal, I mean, it's sort of obvious, right? Because you can put in an additional row of atoms like this, and you have a Burgers factor like that, and you can put it in like this, have a Burgers factor like that.
Right. But here you can put in something like this.
Oh, you can, right? Because nobody says that these stripes are infinitely insulating, right? So you can, when you put the Burgers factor in the stripe direction, charges can move, or things are moving along the stripe direction, and stripes can be regarded as sort of internally metallic. I get all pictures for that. I'm basically saying this doesn't matter, right? Think about stripes as an orthorhombic variety of this square lattice crystal.
Patrick, you have to go past the picture of the stripe as a featureless line. You have to be able to think of compressing charge along the lot of the stripes.
Yeah.
So it would be an internal.
So in this picture, he's basically set the energy of the other type of dislocation to infinity.
Okay. But if it's an empty phase, the main wall, then it's
coming back to, you know, I'm looking at the watch and I'm really going far too slow. I'm coming to this empty phase, the main wall business. Hopefully, I'm going to do that in a very short way. So summarizing, the basic statement is, we start out with purely insulating stripes. They should exist in nature. They do exist in lead nickel oxide, and they likely exist at low dopings in cuprates. Then in the first step, dislocations can proliferate. And this is this new state. We have coined it an ideal quantum pneumatic. And it's a very weird state because it's characterized by purely one-dimensional dynamics. And although it is a quantum fluid of electric charge, it doesn't respond to external electromagnetic fields. Currents cannot flow. Steve sort of suggested that it is quite like a quantum Hall state, right? It's somehow the same reason that sigma x goes to zero is very similar, except that it's impossible to make sigma x y here as well.
But yeah, but that's very closely tied to the assumption that the single particle thing is all
there. Yeah. Then, and I think it's very general, that at a later stage, more expiring system substitutionals are supposed to proliferate. Simple core energy argument. At that moment, this dislocation can move in all directions because of this climb. When you're dealing with a boson system, this will become a superfluid with fermions. You will have some kind of fermions, I think, that Steve et al. Are working on that at the moment. And then there will be a transition.
The substitutions and the substitutions of Cooper pairs, this is still not single particle
excitation. Yep. Yeah, but there are single particle bosons. Who cares about, you know, Cooper pairs and bosons? I find them bosons. Then there's finally a transition where the disk connections proliferate and you're supposed to be an isotropic superfluid.
So just to make sure I understand this intermediate phase again, the argument that the substitutional things don't proliferate and along the dislocation is based on your knowledge that the core energy of a dislocation inside the crystalline state is bigger than the core energy, smaller than the core energy substitutional.
No, quite generally, it's true in any conventional crystal.
I mean, is that the statement is based on, or is that?
That's it. Very simple.
But then one may worry that, I mean, the intuition that you get deep inside the crystalline phase may not correctly tell you what's going to happen as the crystal melts. Right?
When it's a second order transition, you can always think that there's a low fugacity of things out there, and it should still work. It's all pending microscopy, but at the end of the day, dislocations are found in things like iron because the core energies are much lower than that of substitutional effects.
Yeah,
substitutional
really
effects bind together in this connection, and why should it be different in this type of phase?
That's very far away from the melting transition. And you're translating that knowledge all the way up to the melting transition. Basically, the statement you're making is
the melting transition, I mean, when these core energies are different, I don't think.
When the core energy
you can always split it apart into distinct transition, otherwise it would become a first order.
One could imagine the other alternative, maybe it doesn't happen, but one could imagine that when you melt the solid by proliferating dislocations, you immediately go into that super quantum pneumatic phase instead of going through your intermediate.
This is all a matter of microscopic conditions, right? It's just that the most general statement you can make is that there is, in principle, this intermediate state. You can also imagine that first the substitutionals proliferate and you go into a super solid, then dislocations proliferate and you get again into the super pneumatic state.
So if this intermediate thing...
And its order of things is a matter of microscopic numbers and you cannot conclude that on general grounds. It's just no general ground to exclude this phase.
So long as one can establish that that exists as a stable phase, you're allowed to consider this. But that's what I was trying to understand in what we're doing to establish that as a phase.
I think it does. In the same way that you can say disconnections are expensive. That's in general not true. It's not true in ice. Ice melts into water and there's no pneumatic state in the middle. It doesn't seem to be true for two-dimensional triangular lattices, the Nelson-Halperin claim. It seems to be a first-order transition because you cannot suppress these disconnections. They follow the dislocation. So it's always a matter of, you know, microscopic condition, and you can always cook up some solid where this thing can happen in principle. The question is if nature is doing it. And actually, the motivation for all of this was were these interesting experiments by Ushida and co-workers roughly a year ago, finding that in a strongly underdoped X less than 1.8 Bayesian doped strike 2.14 system, there's this phase where it seems that the Hall coefficient, I mean, here's actually sigma xy plotted, but you can also think it's Hall coefficient, dives down at the moment strike charge order sets in and seems to go all the way to zero. And this happens over a large doping range, up to 1.8, all the way from 0.06 to 1.8. Now, the finishing of Hall coefficient is rather hard to explain, especially so when it doesn't seem to relate to particle hole symmetry. And therefore, there was also already a suggestion in this paper that somehow this happens because the currents one-dimensionalize. Now, very generally, when you start out with just a quasi-one-dimensional system, you won't find a finishing of the Hall coefficient, believing at least Steve. Steve has good arguments for that. Different in this ideal pneumatic state, because topology is in charge, and topology makes it possible to really reduce the dimensionality. Now, I won't claim that this is really explaining this. Steve has a different possibility. It might even be boring physics, but at the least, I think it's an interesting possibility. Okay, this is basically the part of the pneumatic state I look on my watch, and I observe that I'm running out of time. So I'm going to try to shortcut the second part and just give you a basic idea. This is about this antiphase boundariness. This antiphase boundariness, when you think about it, sort of weird. What are we saying? We have this O3 spin system, and we are claiming that there are Z2 boundaries, domain walls, in the spin system. It is strange. What the heck is this antiphase boundariness? I need to precisely nail down what antiphase boundariness is, because I need an order parameter in order to think about topological excitations and everything. Now, I'm claiming that there's a way of understanding this which makes me quite happy and makes me sleep well, which is by claiming that it's the one-dimensional variety of just spin separation which is realized in two dimensions, different from the work of Patrick and Central and Matthew, etc., which is about two-dimensional just spin separation. It works differently. The structure, in a sense, looks at the liquids in 2+1 dimensions. A naive way of understanding this, definitely not a scientific way, which is just an intuition, is by looking at these awfully well-known exercises in spin charge separation for kindergarten. Which is basically saying you start out with an anti-ferromagnetic chain, take out an electron, let it hold, delocalize a couple of steps, spins move backwards, and after a while you have here this little domain wall sitting, which is spin on, and this whole dressed up is a domain wall, which is like a holon. Then when you put these holons in a row, what do you get? Guess twice, of course, a stripe. That is, of course, horribly naive. However, I can do a better job, and a better job with regard to defining it as a form of order. And it's basically by going back to a very well-known resource by Okada Shiba, explaining spin charge separation starting from beta onsets. And they go to the very large U limit, where things get very transparent and simple, and they basically inspect the beta onsets wave function to come up with the following picture. What you can do is take a backless holes, distribute them over the lattice. Given the particular configuration of holes, you can now distribute these spins over the lattice, and I pick here an antiferromagnetic configuration for convenience. And when I want to know the spin dynamics, I can get there in a very remarkable way. What I'm supposed to do is take out these holes, with the holes take out these sides. So I squeeze the lattice and think that instead of a hole and a side here, there's a simple exchange bond between these spins. This system, this lattice, is now representative for the true spin dynamics. This inside this is a geometric construction in the sense of Einstein gravity. We, as external observers, are observing this chain, which is holes in it, the spin system doesn't know better than its chains without holes and without these sites. It's effectively a shorter spin chain. Can now push this one step further. It's geometry, but it's a geometry of an extremely simple kind, because this quantum antiferrite magnet only worries about one property of the embedding space, which is sublattice parity. Is it like AB, 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 or BAB, ABA? So, let me call AB, AB, AB plus 1 and BABA minus 1. What's going on here? I have a spin domain here with sublattice parity 1. Then I find a hole. The sublattice parity is flipping because I have taken out, inserted this additional site when I go to the space we observe. So this hole is like an antiferromagnetic bond to a domain characterized by sublattice parity minus 1 and so on. Now, sublattice parity is an isolated degree of freedom. In sublattice parity, I can make domain walls. And that's the C2 symmetry I was looking for, trying to also explain the start of two dimensions. Can push this further, and that is what I believe you really have to do in order to make clear that this is a consistent definition of this order. Everybody here knows these behaviors of the charge-charge correlator, which is the case according to one of x to the power k rho and the spin-spin correlator. This is the case like 1 over x to the power k rho times x to the power k sigma in a one-dimensional system. This is a remarkably simple behavior. It says, yes, the spin fluctuations know, or the spins know about the charge fluctuation, but they do so in a simple multiplicative way.
Charge density wave also has k sigma.
Yeah, I'm looking at 4kF.
4k.
Oh. Right, I think that's sort of a relevant one. I don't quite understand the 2kF from this point of view. Now I can define a non-local correlator, which is exactly taking care of the sublattice parity flip, and it exactly takes out this charge fluctuation out of the spin dynamics. What is it? It's very simple. It's a string operator which says e to the I pi integral from starting point to end point over 1 minus the charge density. So when there's a hole, it's 0. When it's a spin or electron, it's 1. When it's W occupied, it's 2. So when I'm in the spin domain, 1 minus 1 is 0. Nothing happens. E to the I pi 0 is 1. However, when I accumulate one hole, I accumulate net a 1, because 1 minus 0 is 1. E to the I pi is minus 1. Now, this correlator can be calculated, since if it work in recoupling bosonization, and you find the pure spin correlation of the pure Heisenberg system. Why? What is it doing? Every time that it moves through a hole, it flips back the sublattice parity. That's what it's doing. Now, using this definition, which I think is in any sense precise in one dimensions, I can simply imply that it has to happen in two dimensions. So, stripes are obviously doing the same thing, and now I can calculate define a correlation function of the same type. There's actually an interesting freedom in two dimensions, which is not allowed in one dimensions. Namely, I can inform the trajectory of this non-local operator. Then, regardless of what the spin system is doing, when this correlator at long distances becomes independent of the length of this line, I know I have this perfect antiphase boundary. Every time I cross a charge, sublattice parity is flipping. So I have now a definition of an order parameter correlator.
Wait, that would work also if I had, let's say, a majority phase of 1 and little droplets of minus 1. Inside,
yep.
Right? So it doesn't say, it says that the stripes are fully connected, but
it doesn't say that they have to be ordered.
But they don't have to be ordered.
Yeah.
And it's also only in zero temperature, right? If I'm in any non-zero temperature, at least in strictly two dimensions, then I don't have any spin order anyway, and this whole thing stops, right?
Yeah, I think so. Now where it comes from, I refer to microscopic calculations, and I don't want to go into that. It's obvious that if strike dislocation is exactly destroying the sublattice parity order. Right? So let's go below the strike dislocation, it's plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1. Now go above, start out with plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, we are living in the same domain, and at the same time plus 1 and minus 1, and this sublattice order is destroyed. This is clearly an operation which is not allowed in a normal global Ising model. In a global Ising model, stripes have to be, or domain walls have to be infinitely connected. There's of course no reason that this can't happen in cuprate. At the end of the day, when you are at high topics, there cannot be this spin charge separation, whatever order. It has to be destroyed.
Why can't I heal that with some sort of skirmion or one of those funny spin twist things? I mean, the plus the minus.
Let me do it in two steps. It has to be realized that the sublattice parity order is actually coding this geometry. Right? It's only there because the spins live in a particular space, believing it's Okada-Shiba recipe and believing that this is an aligned to two-dimensional stripes. So let's start out with a stripe dislocation, do this Okada-Shiba squeeze. We do it, we contract the lattice here, and what we find is this little pentagon of antiferromagnetic exchange point living at the head of the stripes. Now this is clearly a frustrating effect. So the question to ask is, when you believe that these stripe dislocations proliferate, you can look at them as quantum particles, and every particle carries around this essential frustration. And what the heck is this doing? And we have to ask this question because the ordered stripes apparently have this spin charge separation, whatever order, so we have to destroy it at some point. We cannot afford to ask this question. To come back to Andy's question, we can now think, let's address this frustration on a semi-classical level, so let's put in the spins and let's go to the cell point. How will it look like? This is now staggered order parameter factor. Below the stripe dislocation has to be antiphase boundary. Above, it discovers it has continuous symmetry. So it can repair itself in this way. This texture is like a Hall vortex. It's not a skirmion. This is not conserved in an O3 spin system. So it doesn't have a topological status. So I don't think you can repair it. It's really different from, you know, any way you can disorder an O3 spin system using the topological rules. It's different. Now, to understand for this, a way of understanding this frustration,
yeah,
I now want to,
I mean, this topological object for the spin, what's the problem? It is a pi, it says pi vortex. So you go around it, you have pi, half vortex. So if you allow your spins to go out of the plane,
it has a zero mode, right?
So what's the problem to have a half?
It doesn't carry a topologically conserved charge. Of course, you can think in a semi-classical way that's acting against it. However, you cannot glue it together with the topological recipes for melting the O3 magnet, because for that you need skirmions, etc. It has a different status.
What's the problem for a skirmion to
a mirror? Half skirmion.
Yeah. Spin halves. Why the spin? It will carry spin half. I agree. It's topological
local topological object, unit photon charge will have
the thing you've drawn would cost logarithmically divergent spin energy.
Yeah.
And so what I think Warren's asking is, couldn't you make it cheaper by
getting
it up
next few graph? Next few graph. Where am I with next few graph? Yeah. Thanks. So it's exactly what Steve and Oron are referring to. This thing is logarithmically diverging energy, and it's in many regards like oscillating stars. You expect, I mean, we have proven this actually, but you expect that there is a binary transition where two of these naked dislocations bind together because of logarithmic Lewis and oscillating stars. And topologically, you have then this neutral dislocation. It's neutral with regard to this spin charge separation order. This maintains spin charge separation order. Probably, you know, let me wrap this up. I'm nearly there, and I see that people want to go somewhere else because it takes me all too much time. I think we can discuss this later. Not entirely sure what we're doing here, and actually, it doesn't matter too much, right? So, you expect there to be a phase where the spin charge separation order, quote unquote, is still intact, although the charge order is broken because these are still genuine dislocations, and it can even be superconducting, etc. Right? So something of this kind you expect, ordered stripes, and then you can play all these charge dynamic games, etc., but there should be a phase in between where you're dealing with these pairs of dislocations which only later on unbind. Now, assuming now that the spin system underlying this state where we have these bound dislocation pairs, that is a non-frustrating state, is still staying ordered, be it the next form of order. Saying this way, these stripes are delocalized in space. However, the spins, when there's no domain wall right there, are actually still ordered. This stripe sweeps by. When it sweeps by, the orientation of this spin domain here switches by pi, and we get a state like this. In other words, what we get is here is the overall direction of this underlying spin system. And every time a stripe comes by, it rotates like this. And it can start like this, right, pointing it upward and doing this, and we can start like this, and it will do this. In other words, it's again in a nematic state. And now it's a spin nematic state. This thing has been around for some time, originally invented by Andreev, and I don't want to go in any detail. However, I like to say that the most fundamental way of understanding in general these nematic order parameters is by thinking that actually they are about a dynamically generated local Z2 symmetry. Z2 is this operation of associating North and South Pole. And it's a local symmetry. The way of understanding it is as follows. So we take these big chunks of stripy antiferromagnet, we go to length of order of this charge delocalization scale, right, this truly delocalized stuff, and because there are no frustrations, we can think again that these patches are forming an effective square lattice connected by exchange balls. Now let's now assume that these spins in this neighboring patch are pointing upwards. There are, say, antiferromagnetic balls connecting it to the middle patch, so this middle spin will look downwards. And now do a transformation which at the same time switches, reverses the signs of these antiferromagnetic balls into ferromagnetic balls, and rotate the spin by pi. When you lift this to a local symmetry, you have exactly this nematic that you cannot make up the difference between this and this orientation.
So Jan, this is how you go from a spin to a nematic?
Yeah.
So this is like Roxar and Toner.
I guess so. Very similar. In other words, I can write down a general theory for this, which is nothing else than a Z2 gauge O3, a nonlinear sigma model. And now the issue arises that a C2 theory can have, or a C2 sector can have, a deconfining and a confining state. What I used here is the deconfining state. I don't want to explain the audience as a whole how this case theory is working, because I would like to let you loose. But believe me, there has to be a second phase, which is a confining state. Or is there? So I said there were no free stripe dislocations. Now think about the action of the stripe dislocation. I might as well think that this domain ball, this stripe, is a line of ferromagnetic bonds in the lattice. The stripe dislocation is this line of ferromagnetic bonds coming to an end. Now I can think, I do this operation, but now it's pneumatic. I know that this frustration is around. It breaks this biped tightness, which I used to make this deconfining phase. And Matthew Fisher can tell you that this is exactly the disorder operator of the gate theory, say the instant total product product of C2. In other words, when these stripe dislocations unbind, the instant tones of C2 seed into the Gates vacuum and I get the confining state. In other words, I'm claiming that C2 theory is precisely enumerating the frustrations caused by these stripe dislocations in the system. Can push it a bit further, because the stripe dislocation, at least when glide and clipe and everything is possible, can be looked at as bosons. So when I create a stripe dislocation, I create at the same time a string of wrong bonds as well as a charged boson. In order to get the appropriate term in the action which is causing the confinement, I better cohere this. In other words, better make it a superfluid. Hence, there is sort of an excuse here that only when you are in a superfluid phase, you can really find this confinement at higher temperatures. It all gets very incoherent, and I actually don't know what to think. Now, I'm nearly there, because I have to give this a physical meaning. What the heck is this meaning? First place, it gives an excuse to believe that there can be a commensurate response. Starting out with these stripes, everything is made out of staggered magnetization. There's a charge delocalization scale above which I can think that I can see stripes, below which these stripes have averaged away. It's well known that a spin pneumatic has still a Macnaughton type mode. This Macnaughton type mode is necessarily starting at pi pi. Now I can actually extend this by sort of doing supersuggestive type quantum spin fluctuations and make this into a quantum paramagnetic state causing a mass gap. But if there's now a mass gap in this spin pneumatic Macnaughton, and that thing has to live at pi pi. Now there's one little problem in here. This thing can exist indeed, but neutrons can't see it because neutrons are not C2 singlets. They look at magnetization. Therefore we have excuses of the kind that we don't quite handle the theory, and by five various way we can bullshit about irrelevant violation of the C2 symmetry. When you go away from zero energy, you get violation of C2 symmetry, which sort of keep everything basically intact, except that they might make this thing visible. I know it's an excuse. I see Steve looking at it like he doesn't like it. This one is even more horrible, I guess, because I'm going to claim something in territory which has been taken already by others. That is, what the heck is this meaning of this deconfinement transition? What's happening there? Now, it's all sort of simple, realizing that the C2 symmetry is actually coding for geometry. So C2 global means that there's a definite sense of sublattice parity with static stripes. C2 local deconfining means sublattice parity of one kind, ABAB, is actually equal to BABA. I cannot make up the difference. At this moment, I like to say that there's a minimal condition satisfied to allow for null fermions. C2 local confined means that the whole meaning of ABABBABA is destroyed. This doesn't make sense to think any longer that there are sublattices. I know one think for sure, in a pure BCS vacuum, there's no notion of sublattices. At the same time, this thing is obviously very hidden. Could it be that actually this dislocation and binding, possibly confinement, that is a phase transition, it's dual to global icing, that is underlying this weird quantum critical point business at optimal doping. That in a state above this point, we have a true BCS state. Below this point, we have this hidden business that although ABAB is equal to BABA, still both of them exist. I haven't really worked out the consequences we're thinking about. It's one thing is clear, it's horribly hidden. When you're looking for a hidden symmetry, this one is horribly hidden. Okay, apologies for taking you so long. Let me just summarize. Well, I told you about these two alleys that basically exist next to each other. One of them is actually sort of polishing up lots of established wisdom, finding surprise that there is this ideal pneumatic state in principle. The second alley has been worrying about what the heck is the meaning of antiphase boundariness, and especially we have to destroy it, finding that the frustrations associated with these driver's locations seem to fit rather miraculously on the structure of a C2 gauge theory. Thank you.